This is an iHeart podcast.
There's a great line in the movie, The Good Shepherd. I like that movie, no one else did, but it's a movie kind of about the formation of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the guy who's forming it, he turns to somebody and he says, I really want this agency to be America's eyes and ears, not its heart and soul. But over time, Central Intelligence Agency, they've gone way beyond their purview, and in many ways, they have become the heart and soul of this country. So we're about to dig into this. We're going to look back on some of the scandals, and they're not all from ancient times. Many of these are very recent. Let's figure out exactly what this agency is and what they've been doing, shall we? Mike Benz is going to join us to do that next. Well, if you're going to talk about CIA, scandals at the CIA, I'm not sure that you could find a better guest than my friend Mike Benz, executive director of the Foundation for Freedom Online. He has exposed so much, it's jaw-dropping at this point in time. Okay, Mike, before we get into the scandals, we have so destroyed the intelligence operations in this country that people, they don't even really understand what CIA is supposed to do. What are they supposed to do?
Well, the CIA is supposed to be a plausibly deniable support organization for the U.S. Department of State on national interest grounds and the U.S. Department of Defense on national security grounds, which is a long way of saying that in 1948, when the rules-based international order was set up, we needed a way for the State Department to operate a cloak and dagger plausibly deniable black ops shop in order to do the sorts of things that would cause a diplomatic scandal if it turned out the U.S. government was responsible for. So the U.S. government needed a way to make things happen without looking like the U.S. government did it. And that's on, when it's State Department related, that's usually on U.S. economic grounds or political grounds. And when it's when the CIA work is related to military, it's usually involving paramilitary groups or terrorist groups or other unseemly factions that we are providing military support to. So there's both a political and a military component to what the CIA is supposed to do. The problem is because they are a professional political subversive organization, literally set up to inaugurate organized political warfare. That's the exact term that George Kennan used in his 1948 memo, the inauguration of organized political warfare, to give the CIA its remit. That political warfare can boomerang back on Americans when the U.S. foreign policy establishment thinks that Americans are domestically going to vote for someone who will undermine their preferred foreign policy agenda. That's what you saw in the 1960s when the CIA was playing around at home to influence left-wing groups to stop the anti-Vietnam War movement. That's what you're seeing today as the CIA is working to basically do the same thing to the right wing when it comes to the anti-war or the nationalist rather than globalist wing of the Republican Party.
Now, 1948 to the 60s is not by any stretch of the imagination a long period of time, Mike. So why did they face inward so quickly, or did they really just face inward from the very beginning?
Well, you could argue that they did from the very, very beginning. I think it was that the 1960s is when there really was a break in the bipartisan consensus when it came to the construction of the American empire. There was a fair amount of optimism from the late 1940s into the early 1960s about the purpose of American statecraft and establishing America as the global hegemon in the face of the Cold War with Russia. In the 1960s, the rise of the civil rights movement, the rise of third world peoples movements and anti-imperialist movements, also influenced to some degree by the popularity of Marxism in U.S. universities, led to a breaking of the Republican-Democrat consensus as this ascendant coalition within the Democrats pushed against U.S. interventionalism around the world and pushed against the war in Vietnam. And then that resulted in scandals during the CIA's history, starting in the early 1960s. There was something called Operation Chaos, which was a big disaster for the CIA when it was revealed the CIA was personally intervening in campus politics by sponsoring groups like the National Students Association to effectively bribe young people to write counter-propaganda against the harder left faction. The CIA was busted constructing front groups like the Congress for Cultural Freedom, where they were taking high-level U.S. musicians, writers, thought leaders, poets, visual artists, musical artists, into a sort of CIA artist club. This included not just classical musicians, jazz musicians, writers from high-level magazines, but also feminist thought leaders like Gloria Steinem. And this was all Gloria Steinem herself would later describe her role in the CIA-sponsored Congress for Cultural Freedom as saying that the reason it was so important for the CIA to focus on culture was because you can think of culture as permanent politics. The kind of when culture is established, it sets the boundaries for what politics can and can't do. And so a group like the CIA, whose role is political subversion, first and foremost, sets its sights on control over the culture, which sets the bounds for the politics. During that same period in the 1960s and 70s, the CIA was busted in other scandals, like assassinations of foreign leaders. They assassinated the president of Congo, Lumumba. They assassinated Allende in Chile. They were busted with constructing assassination weapons like the heart attack gun that was held up by Senator Frank Church in the Church Committee hearings. They were busted in scandals like MKUltra, which involved effectively behavioral modification programs, both at the individual and at the group level, to be able to control the psychology of both individuals and political groups. All of this came to a head in 1975 and 1976 during the Church Committee hearings, which established, for the first time in U.S. history, a Senate Intelligence Committee and a House Intelligence Committee to be able to have congressional oversight of the rogue CIA. Jimmy Carter rode to power in 1976 on the back of all this left-wing resentment against the CIA. He went to war with the CIA. He fired 30% of the CIA's operations wing in a single night, 30% in a single night. It was called the Halloween Massacre because it was done on October 31st. He then crippled the CIA's budget and put a CIA director in, Stansfeld Turner, who was basically like the left-wing Cash Patel for the new left Democrats, who basically put huge bumper cars on what the CIA couldn't do. At the time, in the 1970s, Bill Barr was working for the CIA. Bill Barr would go on to be the Attorney General of the United States twice, including during Trump's term. Bill Barr wrote in his biography that he had wanted to become, he told his high school guidance counselor that he wanted to run the CIA, be the director of the CIA when he grew up. He then worked for the CIA directly out of college and went to law school at George Washington University Knight School. He went to Knight Law School while he worked for the CIA. And he said that he only decided he didn't want to run the CIA when Stansfeld Turner, under Jimmy Carter, took power and put the reins on what the CIA couldn't do. Basically, as soon as Bill Barr encountered a CIA leadership who wanted to restrain its cloak and dagger, dark arts powers, Bill Barr said he lost interest in running the CIA at that point, which I think is just kind of funny. But that then led to Ronald Reagan's tenure in the early 1980s. He, of course, came to power on the back of the Iran hostage situation, which the intelligence community in the U.S. argued would have been prevented if the CIA had had its old powers back. So Ronald Reagan quickly went to work trying to get the CIA's old powers back, but ran into a Democrat-controlled Congress who wouldn't let it happen. So he then put the intelligence community through a reorganization that we still live through today, where he basically diffused the CIA's old powers into a pair of institutions, USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy, so that just as the CIA was created to give a layer of plausible deniability to the State Department, USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy became the main plausible deniability layer for the CIA. So it was pushed into this NGO layer. And so I think several of the scandals we're going to be talking about today are at that diffused layer rather than directly at CIA. It's at the CIA liaised rather than CIA run layer, which is where most of CIA work happens nowadays.
Which brings us to the first of the scandals, the fake vaccination drive. What did they do?
Yeah, this was a major international scandal. So in 2011, the CIA set up a hepatitis vaccine clinic. They set up a ring of these in Pakistan. And they publicly advertised this to the Pakistani people that these clinics existed in order to vaccinate the local population against hepatitis in the face of USAID promulgated media that there was a hepatitis outbreak in Pakistan, so everyone needed to get vaccinated. But it turns out it was actually, these were all fake vaccination clinics. The CIA was only luring people into these vaccine clinics in order to collect their biometrics. Now, the official story, as bad as the official story is, officially, when the CIA got busted in this, basically Pakistani intelligence noticed that there was a lot of strange goings on at these vaccine clinics and ultimately discovered that the whole thing was a U.S. intelligence operation that the U.S. later confessed to maintain relations with the Pakistani government and publicly apologized for duping everyone with these fake vaccine clinics. They said the only reason we did it is because we were looking for Osama bin Laden, and so we were collecting everyone's biometric and DNA information. They had a blood sample of the Osama bin Laden family because Osama bin Laden's sister had recently died in Boston. So they collected her blood, and they tried to collect the blood of everyone in Pakistan to identify their way to the up to the Obama the Osama bin Laden family. But of course, even that cover story, as scandalous as that is on its own, I think is quite a whopper of a lie unto itself. You see, as this was playing out, David Petraeus had announced in a doctrine that he called identity dominance, which was part of U.S. counterinsurgency doctrine, that they were having a problem with being able to contain guerrilla anonymous group activity where people were showing up in large crowds in protests. It was hard to be able to pinpoint in targeted strikes all of the troublemakers in the area, so they wanted to collect the biometric data and the biological data of what they said was 85% of the population in Iraq, in Syria, in Pakistan, in all these Central Asian conflict zones. And so while the U.S. military had announced that they wanted 85% of the country's DNA and eyeballs so that they would be able to have identity dominance and pick out basically anyone in a crowd, be able to instantly ID anyone who was a troublemaker, they were running these vaccine clinics in order to collect that, which I think if they were busted in Pakistan, there's an open question of how many vaccine clinics were playing this role around the world. You know, there's a lot of terrorist groups. There's terrorist groups in Africa. There's terrorist groups in Eastern Europe. There's terrorist groups in South America. How many of these public health facilities have been operating as CIA fronts? Adjacent to that, in 2014, so that was under the Obama administration, also under the Obama administration in 2014, the CIA was busted running a fake HIV AIDS clinic, which was set up nominally to help solve the HIV breakouts in Cuba. And it turned out that those clinics were actually operating as a paramilitary transport hub, where the U.S. was sending weapons and paramilitaries into Cuba under the front of a AIDS clinic. So you see these public health facilities that are held up in foreign countries, and yet they're operating as intelligence and paramilitary fronts, because no one would think to look at a vaccine clinic or an HIV clinic as a hub of CIA activity, and so it's allowed to go on for years. But how many other countries have they done this in, if they've been caught there?
I can't help, with all this talk about vaccines, think back to COVID. Did what they do have any impact on how that propaganda was pushed here, do you think?
Well, it's hard not to see it. And in fact, it's not just that it was the same sort of playbook in a certain way, because what came along with COVID vaccines was contact tracing. Everything, all of your phone data, everything moving into the QR codes, they contemporaneously rolled out at DHS, under which TSA is tucked, mandatory eyeball scanning in domestic travel. So the same way that U.S. Marines used to go around in Iraq and Syria and Pakistan lifting up people's eyeballs all over the country in order to snap a picture so that the U.S. military would have their eyeballs in a database. So anytime they showed up on a drone camera participating in a protest activity against U.S. government operations, every single hostile adversary to the State Department could be ID'd in terms of who they are and where they live. The same thing did indeed come home under the COVID era. There's only the question now of what exactly they're doing with that data, but undeniably they have collected it. But I would like to point out one other aspect of this, which is that Henry Kissinger in 2000, who was the U.S. Secretary of State, as well as National Security Advisor, U.S. Secretary of State is this sort of symphony orchestra conductor of CIA operations. The CIA answers most directly to the State Department because they are, nominally it's the National Security Council, but because they serve the State Department, they have to synchronize with the State Department. So the State Department reads all the CIA analyst memos and coordinates the covert activity in the region so that it's in sync with the overt action being done by the State Department. And so Henry Kissinger is a very senior figure who looms large over the CIA's evolution in the 20th century. In the year 2000, he wrote a book, and the final chapter of the book includes a blueprint for the 21st century. And he talks about the importance of humanitarian interventions as a modality to project U.S. soft power because of its success in the 1990s in giving U.S. intelligence access to places they would not have access to if they did it under the banner of national security or military intervention. And he gives the examples of Cuba, Haiti, several African countries, and Yugoslavia, basically talking about how these public health structure hubs and these poverty relief programs and all these different humanitarian expenditures of U.S. aid money to build up institutions in foreign countries, ostensibly to help the poor or the sick, were an extremely effective method to gain political control over 7 to 10 different countries over the 1990s. And Henry Kissinger called for a radical upscaling of that capacity in the 21st century in order to continue the momentum they had just had over overthrowing the government of Yugoslavia and balkanizing Yugoslavia into Serbia, Bosnia Herzegovina, Kosovo. And so Dr. Peter Hotez actually started out his career as Hotez, who had become this very senior, almost spokesman figure during the COVID era. Folks remember he's the kind of crazy doctor with the frizzy hair and the bow tie who's sort of like a discount Bill Nye the Science Guy, but for the Pentagon, and working out of this strange lab at Baylor University, and the guy who wrote a whole book about how anti-vaxxers are effectively should be treated like terrorists. and that no one should be able should be debating anti-COVID or vaccine skeptical or lockdown skeptics on Joe Rogan. He famously turned down all these debate requests because he was afraid of getting blown out, but his cover is he didn't want to legitimize them. Well, in 2004, this was 20 years, I guess 15 years before COVID broke out. In 2004, Dr. Peter Hotez began writing a series of articles that he called Vaccines as Instruments of Foreign Policy. And everyone can look this up. They're published on PubMed. He wrote about five articles on this topic. And he specifically cites Henry Kissinger's book in 2000. And he, as a doctor, as a medical professional, says we need to double and triple down on vaccine diplomacy because it's a useful instrument of U.S. statecraft to be able to project U.S. soft power into foreign countries by establishing a hub of influence under cover of public health. He says vaccines, basically, whether they work or not, they get you in the door. You now have a U.S. money pumping through the veins of that economy. These institutions can then put pressure on the local governments in the same way that Pfizer puts pressure on our media ecosystem here, our advertising networks. Pfizer funds politicians. Once you get the money in and the hubs of influence built up, then it doesn't really matter if the vaccines work or not. They have a dual use. And so Peter Hotez wrote that in 2004, and then he continued to write about that topic for the rest of his career, and he comes out as the leading, you know, spokesman in many respects, you know, other than Anthony Fauci himself and a handful of little mini czars. But then you see the strange role of the CIA throughout all of COVID. You know, that the Wuhan lab was actually funded to the tune of $15 million by USAID, which is one of the most frequent CIA cutouts. And we'll be talking, I think, about USAID and some of these other scandals. You had Avril Haines, who was the deputy director of the CIA, who took part in the Event 201 pre-planning exercise just 2 months before COVID broke out. Avril Haines, who is now Biden's director of national intelligence, she was the deputy director of the CIA, the number two of Obama's CIA, who gave a whole panel dissertation at Event 201 on the importance of pre-censoring anyone who on media or social media who questioned the origins of this mystery outbreak in this hypothetical exercise about a coronavirus breaking out in China in October 2019, 2 months before the breakout of a coronavirus in China in December 2019 that would go on to be called COVID-19. You have the initial censorship all being done by these CIA front groups like Graphica, whose chief strategy officer worked for 25 years from the CIA and who was incubated in the Minerva Initiative, which is the U.S. Department of Defense's Psychological Operations Research Center. So that was the first organization to begin censoring COVID-19 narratives online. They started that work right as the outbreak happened. December 16th is when their own documents say they started doing their censorship work. And so the whole thing was laced with CIA top to bottom. Now, it's unclear whether that was just simply to contain the scandal of a military-generated coronavirus from these, you know, the DARPA grants in 2018 that created the capacity for these foreign cleavage sites and the jumping from bat to human. But the fact is the CIA is all over that story, just like they were all over the fake vaccine clinics in Pakistan and the fake HIV clinics in Cuba. But it really begs the question of when you look at the size of the public health sector, that it's, you know, most of U.S. expenditures are spent on public health. We have this vast apparatus in Africa, this vast apparatus in Eastern Europe, this vast public health apparatus in Central Asia, this vast public health apparatus in the Western Hemisphere and South America. How many, if these are just the ones they got busted for, and these are professional intelligence agencies and organizations whose job is to hide this, if they've been busted twice, are there 200 of these that they haven't been busted in? How much of the economy, how much of the economic lifeblood is serving as a sort of protected soft power influence for U.S. intelligence.
Good grief. Okay, let's get to number two here. CIA,
look at Donald Rumsfeld.
Speaking of Cuba.
Well, sorry, last thing, if I can just get this out. Donald Rumsfeld, who was George Bush's Secretary of Defense, the head of the entire U.S. military. What was he doing right before he became the head of the Secretary of War? He was a pharmaceutical bro. He was running Gilead. He was the CEO of it, which is the same organization that would come back with these COVID pharmaceutical treatments. And it was run by Donald Rumsfeld. So once again, it's the military and medicine.
Yeah. Let's go to number two, Mike. CIA creating a fake Twitter in Cuba? Wait, what?
Yes. So this is another one of these CIA scandals during the Obama administration. And this one is really amazing because it just speaks to so many different levels of the Truman Show that can get created around your life, where you think everyone you meet is, you know, your friend or a random stranger, when it's, you know, indeed an entire structure around you can be a careful creation of U.S. operation. So what happened in the Zunzuneo scandal is Cuba had banned Twitter in the late 2000s because they were concerned that it was that U.S. social media was a tool of the U.S. state in order to turn Cubans against their government. Now, by the way, I don't like the Cuban government. I'm as anti-communist as they come. This is not to, you know, when I break down this scandal, this is not to be sympathetic to communist governments. This is only so that you sort of KYC, you sort of know your customer when it comes to what the CIA and its spinouts do. So, in 2011, the Arab Spring was well underway, where the U.S. was in the process of using Twitter and Facebook to topple governments around the world, particularly Middle East, North Africa. We were about 5 years into this CIA State Department digital diplomacy initiative, which was this idea that you could run CIA operations not just out of U.S. embassies and consulates and CIA station houses, but that you could actually run operations online through social media, because everyone you want to recruit for street protests or to raid the presidential palace in a color revolution could be recruited on Facebook and could be mobilized in Twitter hashtags or could be mobilized through viral YouTube videos. And so while the Arab Spring was going on in Tunisia and Egypt, and this was extremely successful in Middle East, North Africa, the State Department got the brilliant idea that they could bring about a Cuban Spring in Cuba if only they could get U.S. social media platforms into the country. And so what the CIA did through USAID is they took these humanitarian relief funds that were earmarked by USAID for Pakistan, and they redirected them through a Byzantine set of shell companies to be delegated to this private sector CIA contractor called Creative Associates International, CAI, not CIA, CAI. And what CAI did under the direction of USAID and the Central Intelligence Agency is they created a direct Twitter knockoff, literally copied the exact user interface of Twitter. At one point in the scandal, the State Department actually directly reached out to Jack Dorsey to help co-run it. Jack Dorsey reportedly declined, and so they descended on Cuba using the front of being two music promoters at Creative Associates International to convince Cuban nationals to run this in order to evade the scrutiny of the Cuban government. So it would look like it was a Cuban social media company set up by Cubans rather than a CIA operation using funds earmarked for Pakistan, then transferred to a CIA contractor and then transferred to friendly Cubans in Cuba. And so Zunzuneo means mockingbird, or means hummingbird. So basically, it's they took the Twitter bird idea. They took, you know, the like button, the retweet button. They took the same user interface, and they recruited about 60,000 Cubans onto this platform. And the documents, I can actually read some of the direct quotes here, because it's just incredibly shocking how devious this whole thing went down. So there was a surveillance dimension to this CIA social media Twitter knockoff, where they collected a vast database. I'm reading a direct quote, a vast database of Cuban Zunzuneo subscribers, including their age, gender, and receptiveness and political tendencies, to be built in the future. And this is according to these leaked documents that you can find online. These are now, you know, leaked USA documents. They created a database of every user's political tendencies for political purposes, in order to use that data to micro-target efforts towards anti- and pro-government users. So basically, they segmented all the users according to data to how receptive each user would be to programming and algorithms in their newsfeed to form what they called smart mobs. That is, to form rental riots if they were given programming to meet up and join this protest. And so they initially lulled people to the platform. The way they got 60,000 users in the first place in Cuba is, according to the USA documents, is they started with non-controversial content such as sports, music, and hurricane updates to build up subscribers, and then introduced political messaging to encourage smart mobs and anti-government dissent. So basically, they knew that if the algorithms favored overthrowing the government from Jump Street, nobody would join. But if they safely got hundreds of thousands, which was their goal, of people to the platform, and then once they were already on and locked in and dependent on it, they switched up the algorithms to promote anti-government sentiment, to get them to hate their government, to get them to take to the streets and riot, that they'd be locked in a captive audience to do so. So if they're doing that with Cuban Twitter, I think this goes a long way towards explaining the era we just went through with the massive CIA infiltration of actual Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, where a huge chunk of the trust and safety team in all three of the U.S. major social media companies came to be infiltrated by folks with direct ties to the Central Intelligence Agency.
Good God. All right, finally, I have to ask before I let you go for the grand finale, what did they do in Bangladesh?
Well, this is incredible. So this just happened 3 months ago. So earlier this year, the U.S. overthrew the government of Bangladesh. There was a longstanding prime minister named Sheikh Hasina, who was a very popular, democratically elected prime minister, who was basically at political war with the United States. She refused to allow the U.S. to build a military base in Bangladesh. She sort of was refusing to allow Bangladesh to be used for soft power projection purposes by the U.S. into China and India. And there were several conflicts with Myanmar and neighboring regions. So the U.S. wanted regime change. There's so many components to this story, it's mind-boggling. But effectively, the long and short of it is, in 2018, the CIA, USAID, and the U.S. State Department all provided tens of millions of dollars to the political opposition group called the Bangladesh National Party, the BNP, in order to win the election against Hasina, the prime minister. But they lost, and they lost very badly. It was a very lopsided, one-sided election. And so the State Department was very dejected about losing the 2018 election. So a CIA cutout called the International Republican Institute, the IRI, this was set up. The IRI is the GOP offshoot of the National Endowment for Democracy, NED. NED was the central linchpin of the 1983 reorganization of the CIA. It was conceived in William Casey's office, that was the CIA director under Ronald Reagan, in order to be able to fund groups backed by the CIA without them getting direct funding from the CIA. They'd be funded instead by the IRI and the NDI, which is the DNC offshoot of the NED. So this is a born dyed in the wool CIA cut out. Literally, its existence is owed to a letter from the CIA director to set them up as a means to funnel money to CIA backed groups without having the CIA claim the CIA's direct fingerprints on it. So the IRI submitted a memo to the State Department in 2018. They called it a baseline assessment, and this is a standard thing that's done when U.S. intelligence is trying to get the lay of the land in a region for how to run an operation. They do a baseline assessment of all the assets that they have in the region that can be instrumentalized in an operation. And in their baseline assessment, they wrote that it would be politically infeasible for BNP to win the next election organically. That is, they simply didn't have the votes. They lost too badly in this previous election. So they needed instead a strategy to, quote, destabilize Bangladesh politics and to overthrow it in a color revolution through street protests combined with poaching members of the Bangladeshi military to coup the prime minister out of office. But there's a cute trick here that they pulled, which is, so they, in this baseline assessment, they surveyed all the different groups within Bangladesh who hated the government that was just elected. And what they settled on were two racial minority groups in Bangladesh, the LGBTQ community, and student groups at Bangladeshi universities who primarily listened to music like hip-hop and rap. And so what the IRI, the CIA cutout, then proceeded to do over the next six years was build up a network of 270 assets across the LGBT community, across the Bangladeshi rap and hip-hop community, and across the community leaders of these two racial ethnic groups in order to drive up anti-government dissatisfaction and get them to take to the streets in protests, hundreds of thousands of people strong, in mostly peaceful protests that included violence, arson, riots, and attacks on police, in order to throw Sheikh Hasina out of office, which they successfully did. They literally raided the presidential palace. She had to flee the country in a helicopter. She was replaced by a guy who was a former Clinton Global Initiative fellow, who Sheikh Hasina, the ousted prime minister, had tried to indict on corruption probes and was only stopped when then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton personally threatened to have the IRS audit her son, who was living in the U.S., if she proceeded with that. But I just want to read, just before we sign off on this, I want to read a few direct quotes from these leaked documents from the IRI about their involvement in the CIA running the rap game in Bangladesh. This is incredible. I'm now reading the direct grants that were given in 2020 and 2021. So here is a Bangladeshi hip-hop artist named Taufiqi Ahmed. And here is what IRI writes to the State Department. Taufiqi Ahmed released the first of two music videos under the IRI's small grants program for his song Tui Perish, which means you can do it, which targets youth in Bangladesh with a message of perseverance in difficult times and encourages them in every possible way, including protests and street movements. The video was produced by IRI and released on YouTube and Facebook. Then they have a second entry, another grant, another U.S. taxpayer money distribution to rappers in Bangladesh to overthrow the government. Taufiqi Ahmed released his second music video titled E-Day-Kaar. The song's lyrics address a variety of social issues, including poverty and workers' rights. The song was designed to reveal social issues in Bangladesh and build up disappointment and dissent to government so as to call for social and political reforms. So the song was designed by the Central Intelligence Agency to build up disappointment and dissent with the government. They even include links to the music videos, which are pretty hilarious, if I can say. But they ended up recruiting 11 different hip-hop artists, putting them on CIA payroll, and then blaring them to hundreds of thousands of Bangladeshi students in, you know, a sort of Derek Zoolander-style call to listen to this music and take to the streets to overthrow their government. I should note that the Obama administration CIA did the same thing in Cuba with a rap group called the San Ysidro Movement. But this happened starting in the Trump era and then continued. But it's just very funny also when you consider that this is the IRI, which is the GOP wing of the CIA. Oh, and their work with the LGBT community was amazing as well. They spent U.S. taxpayer money on transgender dance festivals in order to normalize within the political opposition in Bangladesh, because these transgender and gay groups were at the forefront of the street paramilitary activity. They were effectively acting as a local Antifa. And so you had the Republican CIA promoting transgender dance festivals with CIA rap themes in order to do a BLM-style overthrow of the government.
Good golly. That just happened. Mike, you are the best, man. That was a freaking wealth of information. Thank you. Keep them on for another hour. I think we should probably wrap up, don't you? We'll do that next. We have to bring the Central Intelligence Agency to heel. And that gets very, very difficult, doesn't it? Because we're talking about taking on an agency whose job, as we just heard Mike Benz lay out, whose job has been to destabilize governments, regime change around the world. So we need the government to take on the agency who is specially trained to take on the government. I realize that creates a big problem, but it can be done. What we need is a House and Senate and President with the courage to do so, because you cannot have a bunch of unelected spy chiefs running the United States of America, and we most definitely cannot have the civilian oversight of the Central Intelligence Agency afraid to do oversight. It doesn't work that way. Otherwise, you might as well just hand them the keys to the country. So, going forward, we're going to need courage. I think we can do it. We'll do it again.
This is an iHeart podcast.